Hey, Eli.
Hey, Jake, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Appreciate you taking the time. I first discovered you recently, actually, from your election polling website, or rather, election prediction website, kind of tracking the probability that, Trump or Biden would come out on top on a state basis using some information from Betfair. Is really cool. And then I started reading your blog and found some really interesting material on there. So as far as I understand, you're a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State. Before that, spent some time at George Mason as well as at Boom working on supersonic flight. So, as we get started, would love to just kind of hear your story of kind of how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me, Jake. My story is, 10 or 15 years ago, I wanted to be an economics professor, and so I went to grad school at George Mason, and where a lot of my sort of intellectual heroes are in the economics department, and had a wonderful time in grad school. But along the way, I sort of decided I didn't want to be an economics professor. And so kept working on the PhD, but also sort of nurtured this sort of like side interest in technology and policy through blogging and through other things. And eventually landed a job at the Mercatus Center in the tech policy program. And sort of, from there, sort of like worked on a bunch of things. Actually, cryptocurrency was one of the first things I worked on. I've been following the crypto space since about 2011. Did a bunch of stuff on cybersecurity, on internet governance, on intellectual property, and then also on drones. I was one of the first people to work on drone policy and trying to outside of the sort of nascent drone industry. And then kind of got to the point where I did everything I wanted to do on that, and then started working on supersonic policy and wrote a paper called Make America Boom Again that sort of kicked off the policy conversation on supersonics. And then got hired on at Boom as the first policy hire, and sort of spent 2.5 years there, working with Congress, working with sort of the UN, ICAO, which is the UN agency that works on aviation policy, and of course, FAA domestically. And sort of laid the groundwork for the supersonic renaissance that I think is coming. There's now a bunch of supersonic startups. And then earlier this year, joined up, decided to go back to the think tank world, and joined up at the Center for Growth and Opportunity, where I work on what I call like hard technology, and figuring out sort of the policy changes that we need to nurture hard technology and really get economic growth moving as fast as possible.
It's great, and I appreciate you sharing the story. I want to dig in on a few points there. First and foremost, George Mason, there seems to be a lot of really bright minds there, and bright minds coming out of there. And outside looking in, like I wasn't really familiar just a year ago, and then started reading a little bit from Tyler. Had Mark Lutter on the show earlier. Now you, what's going on there that this intellectual, group is getting together and going out and doing the, spreading these amazing ideas and doing these amazing things.
Yeah, so the GMU Econ Department is a really amazing, unique place. I think so. Tyler Cowen was my PhD advisor, and I took every class I could with him. I took every class I could with Alex Taparok, with Brian Kaplan, with Robin Hanson, and they're just sort of a sort of like a merry band of really awesome thinkers about the world, about social science. And it's just, it's a great place to spend a few years, sort of like soaking it all in. So, I absolutely, even though I sort of had this like complete career change, after I went, I still think is like a great part of my life, and I'm so glad I got to do that. I think they just sort of I think they kind of do a Moneyball strategy in terms of, you know, finding intellects that aren't properly valued in the sort of like the global, you know, mainstream academic marketplace, and they provide a home for them. And it's, I think that strategy has worked. You know, as you pointed out, we get a lot of we've gotten a lot of really great people, you know, hired on there as faculty and also passing through as, you know, as students.
So it's sort of like the Peter Thiel find discover undiscovered talent type of thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's fine that it's talent. It's not even just like undiscovered. It's like people who obviously have talent, but for whatever reason, the Harvards, the Chicagos, the, you know, what are the mainstream sort of econ programs don't really value them as highly. You know, those, a lot of those places, they value like really like mathy, technical work above all else. And I think at GMU in the econ department, it's a lot more focused on, do you have meaningful things to say about the world? And you know, that, you know, that's to me is like sort of the core idea, I guess, is that it's people who do have real ideas about the world and not just sort of performing, you know, what the profession expects of them.
Right, so a little bit of a different criteria, like you mentioned, with the Moneyball strategy.
Right.
Was it back then that you started getting into crypto? You mentioned 2011, obviously
Yeah.
super early.
Yeah, it's pretty early. So I started following crypto in 2011. Sort of just came across it. So my PhD dissertation was actually on anarchy, or part, you know, part of it was anyway. And so, you know, I was doing a lot of study on various anarchist ideas and kept coming across, like, it was just very early in that world where, like, you know, there would be like you'd follow some like thing about anarchy, and you'd get to, or anarcho-capitalism, and you'd get to Bitcoin. And so I started looking into it, and was just really interested in it. I thought there were some obviously really interesting implications for power dynamics, and so I started writing about it and blogging about it. And I think actually like that's probably why I landed my job at later at Mercatus. So the guy who was running the tech policy program at Mercatus before I took over and before he left was Jerry Brito, who in 2014 who collaborated with me on some of the crypto policy stuff, and we co-authored you know, a piece on it. But in 2014 he left Mercatus to go start Coin Center, which now does full-time cryptocurrency advocacy. So we, you know, so crypto, you know, was a big part of that early few years of my policy career.
Right. So you've seen the story kind of unfold for, from a front row seat for more time than most people have. You know, even people who have been mining since 2012 or 2013, that feels early. They're talking about how, Bitcoin was in the tens or hundreds of dollars at that point. You're discovering this somewhat serendipitously, looking into anarchy and all paths kind of lead to Bitcoin. At that point, obviously, like with the white paper, it was regarded as, an intended, you could say, as a peer-to-peer cash and a payment system versus the view now that it's become more of a digital gold. And obviously, the entire crypto world has been built on and more so around it. I want to talk about your views on Ethereum later as well. But how
Sure.
have you seen kind of the Bitcoin narrative change over time? And like, I would imagine, when you first discover, in my personal opinion, anyone who kind of first discovered Bitcoin as early as you did to express like a certainty and its eventual success would be, you could be right. And, to some extent you have been, but at that early stage, it was much less secure in terms of its future. And, just because you're right in retrospect, and now it's a 300 billion market cap type of thing. Doesn't mean that that was necessarily sound judgment, but now we have this thing and it's a little bit different than what people back then might have thought could drive its success. How have you just kind of seen all of this play out?
Yeah, so I think that my first reaction to this was a couple different things. So my first reaction was, well, this is going to be used for drugs, right? So this is going to be used to buy and sell drugs, and sort of thinking about the way that fiat currencies take off, like conventional fiat currencies take off, there is an element of state force behind them, right? So essentially the dollar has taken off as a currency because the US government accepts it and in fact mandates it as payment for taxes, right? So there is that element of force that can sort of bootstrap the value of a fiat currency. And my first reaction was, well, if this is being used for drugs, then it's almost like the apparatus of the state is forcing people to use this this otherwise valueless token for certain kinds of transactions. And that's kind of the same thing as the government using its own tax authority or tax power to sort of to bootstrap the value of a conventional fiat currency. So that was like my first reaction, was like, wow, this is really interesting because it's got all these power dynamics flowing through it. And then of course, I think the second reaction was I really came to appreciate how big of an advance this was in terms of computer science and in terms of actually being able to create a centralized yet unowned resource, right? So a resource that it's decentralized in architecture, but it's a central sort of unique monolithic resource that yet nobody owns. And I thought that was altogether new. And that's sort of what convinced me that the idea was around to stay. And then I started thinking about sort of the potential uses, as, you know, both as payments, but then as for other things. Back in the sort of early days, maybe, oh, I don't know, this is not so early, maybe 2014-ish or so, 2013, 2014, people were talking about colored coins, which we now call tokens. But the idea of colored coins sort of on the Bitcoin network was going around. I thought that was interesting. And then there were a bunch of, you know, sort of other ideas going around that time, proof of existence, sort of proof of sacrifice as like sort of a way of doing identities on the blockchain. So I thought those were all really interesting ideas, and I was just really eager to see where it would all go. But I was pretty sure that the fundamental architecture of this sort of unowned centralized resource would be around to stay. And I think, and even today, like, you know, I don't claim to know exactly where the industry is going to go, but I am pretty sure that that idea is going to be around for a long time.
Right. So you wrote, and just on your, you know, using Bitcoin for drugs point, I read that you had, you know, written about this, an article called Can the War on Drugs Bootstrap Bitcoin, back in,
right,
you know, mid 2011, which is, you know, again, you don't really see people writing stuff. At least I don't really come across people having written stuff like this, you know, almost a decade ago. So it's pretty prescient seeming to read now, even, you know, some points may have come to fruition more so than others across the board, yep. But pretty impressive, and again sounds somewhat serendipitous and meant to be, and certainly, you know, drove, you know, at least redirected the course of your life from there on forward, it sounds like, in arriving at George Mason later and everything like that. Now I read more recently, I think it was January 2018, you wrote about how you know, basically a case for Ethereum maximalism, and so Bitcoin maximalism is extremely popular. There's basically a set of people who think like it's all about Bitcoin and nothing but Bitcoin when it comes to crypto, and everything else is, you know, not real or not sustainable. And then there's also a group of people who are really into these alternative coins, these tokens. I think you mentioned like color coins, they might've been called in the early days, and just, you know, alternatives to Bitcoin that might serve different purposes or same purposes in slightly different ways, like Zcash with some anonymity involved and privacy. But you have this pretty unique perspective, even versus, I think you mentioned in the post, some of the people who helped create Ethereum and some of the people who are at the core of working on it and developing it today. You don't really often hear this case of people, you know, having a view of Ethereum maximalism, that Ethereum is going to be the winner take all. And, you know, it might not be a monopoly of a market, but if there's, you know, seven winners or three winners or whatever it might be, your view tends to be, or at least was a couple of years ago or so, that Ethereum looked like the likely winner. And you drove, you know, a number of points as to why that might be, and acknowledged that Bitcoin was ahead in terms of network effects and the market cap, and in terms of, you know, the mining and the security and the volume and liquidity. But Ethereum really had the edge on a lot of different aspects of, you know, what makes a good cryptocurrency. And then separately, a ton of people are just building on top of it. Could you shed some light on like what your views are there today?
Sure. I mean, my fundamental like framework on thinking about this hasn't changed, which is that, you know, for a coin, a cryptocurrency to be successful in the sort of in the long run, it's got to be better than every other coin in at least one dimension. Right. So for it to be a meaningful player in the long run, it's got to have one, at least in sort of every pairwise comparison with other coins, it's got to have like one advantage. If another coin is better at it than everything, then why wouldn't people just use that other coin? Right. And so, so that was basically how I was looking at, and still do really look at, you know, Ethereum and Bitcoin. You know, I think, you know, Bitcoin, you know, did then and still does have a bigger market cap. And in that sense, it has a bigger network effect. But, you know, it's not hard to imagine that Ethereum would at some point get a higher market cap than Bitcoin. And at that point, it seems to me like the value proposition for Bitcoin completely collapses. There's really the reason to use it is because it is, you know, the highest mind share one, or the most liquid one, the biggest network effect one. And if that ceases to be the case, then, you know, there really is no good other, you know, secondary reason for using it. So I think the other point is, you know, are we in the early days of cryptocurrency, or are we in the mature days of cryptocurrency? You know, I think a lot of people think, you know, at least a couple of years ago, when I was writing that, people were saying, oh, we're in sort of like the Netscape era of cryptocurrency. It's like we've shown the major use case, and, you know, we need to mature it and so on. And I think that that's wrong. I think we're still in very, very early days for cryptocurrency. Like if you want to compare it with the internet, I would say we're in the ARPANET days, where we're figuring out the protocols still, and we're very long way from it sort of mass usage, at least in terms of the development work that needs to happen. So you know, that means that you know, sort of with Bitcoin's seems to me that the core network is like, it's from the perspective of the Bitcoin community, is it should be frozen. It shouldn't really change very much. And to my mind, there still needs to be a lot of change, a lot of development that goes on in the cryptocurrency ecosystem to make it something that actually is usable by billions of people. You know, I think even, I don't know if this is still true, but because there have been, efficiencies, but at one point it was like, if every human being on the planet were to open a Lightning channel once and close it once, like there wouldn't be enough transaction space on the Bitcoin blockchain to do that. So we're still very far away from you know, be achieving really large scale effects. And I think Ethereum is you know, the closest to getting there, and it, and in the most, at least, you know, between of the two blockchains, Ethereum is more open to change and more open to evolution and continued development. So to me, that really points to, you know, I think it's very possible that 5 years from now or whenever, you know, whenever, you know, Ethereum has moved to, you know, more efficient algorithms, proof of stake, et cetera, but then also is, you know, gets to a point where it's beating Bitcoin in sort of like every dimension. And if it gets to that point, I think it's game over for Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's, I appreciate you laying that out. And it's a really interesting perspective that, you know, even if it's not right in the long term, I think that it's under, the perspective is almost underhad or underrepresented versus Bitcoin maximalism right now. And I'm not sure, I don't have, you know, I always kind of fall back on like, I don't know what I don't know. And so my approach to it has been basically to, you know, plus or minus when I got in, allocated based on market cap, so that if, you know, proportional to market cap, so that if Ethereum does, you know, surpass Bitcoin in terms of its value, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter all that much to me. And I obviously I'll lose on one bet if they don't both go up, but theoretically I would win on the other. And like, right, I didn't take that all the way down, but it just hedges my bets a little bit. And I don't have a strong view. I've spent a lot more time on Bitcoin and have much more confidence in my understanding of it. But I think that what you mentioned, I want to point out or call out two things, two aspects of what you're saying. The first is that, you know, you operate, your first assumption sort of was that you have to be the best at a specific thing to dominate. You can't be not the best at a specific thing and be super successful.
But you can't be worse at everything than some other project.
Yeah. Right? So I find your perspective like super compelling. And I'm not, you know, countering it as much as I'm just pushing back with an example that I've heard. I'm actually not, you know, I was born basically with the internet in the early 90s. And so wasn't really, you know, around to see the development of the last technology that people are kind of, you know, regarding as comparable to what crypto may be.
Right.
But I hear of an example that's brought up in to kind of challenge that assumption, which is basically that like email took off and wasn't, you know, was far from perfect. Like there's no read receipts and there's certain, you know, features that are not in it, but it kind of came to prominence, you know, so quickly that, you know, it just won and the battle was over before there was time for, you know, something smaller but better to win. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that necessarily applies here, but I think it's an interesting counter of some sort. And then separately, like to support your point, what I think is super interesting is you talked about like it depends on how early we are. And the way that I see it is very similar. Like I think first and foremost, like your piece is super compelling because you hear a lot of cases, or not really, honestly, but you hear some cases against Bitcoin and they're typically from people who haven't invested the time to understand. Clearly you've invested some time over a longer time horizon than almost anyone in understanding all of this. And you have what I think is a pretty compelling case to be made that it could ultimately not be very valuable. And I think looking at it as a long-term race, and we're in the very early stages, and it's like the way I think of it, is basically like if you had a horse race and, you know, the number one horse is ahead by a few feet, but it's only 10% into the race, that's much different than the horse being ahead by 10 feet, you know, in the middle of the race. And like, at that point, it's already, you know, more likely to be determined or whatever the distance is, you get what I mean. I tend to agree with you that it's extremely early. And so that network effect advantage may or may not be you know, important at this stage? Do you have kind of a perspective on all that?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, so first of all, like I one thing to maybe clarify is that, you know, when I call the case for Ethereum maximalism, like the title is a little bit tongue in cheek, right? Because I do think it's like very possible that there will be additional coins in the future, or additional blockchains that are better than Ethereum on one specific dimension, right? Or on some other specific dimension that people value. So like Zcash is a great example where they have these sort of like native private transactions. And that's not something that that exists on the Ethereum chain. And it could be that, that, you know, there's a place in the long run for that kind of coin as well. And you could even imagine Bitcoin adding at some point that kind of native base layer capability, and then that would be a case for Bitcoin sticking around. So I don't think it's like permanent maximalism. I think just based on it was really an argument based on the coins that were out at the time. And I think even at the end of the piece, I say like this might not be permanent. There might be other technologies that are adopted in future coins that sort of make the case for a more pluralistic ecosystem. I mean, the other thing is that like, I still come down to like the view of like money as like, you have to spend it. Like the idea for it to be money. And so the idea of like, of the comparison with email, it's like, okay, like email still isn't great, right? But we're all kind of like locked into it because of the network effects of the protocol. But I don't see like that many people, like the actual usage of Bitcoin as money is extremely low, right? It's pretty small. So a lot of it is just people holding it for a long period of time or sort of speculating, you know, trading it in order to moving it around, essentially to move it to an exchange and trade it on the exchange. You know, that's not really money. I mean, that's just like a speculative asset that, and sort of the network effects for speculative assets, they aren't the same as the network effects for money. You know, money has this like sort of acceptance quality that you'll, you know, accept it as payment for things. And I still don't see like, you know, the ability, you know, a huge demand or, you know, people offering to use it for commerce on the internet. I think at one point Stripe experimented with adding Bitcoin support and nobody used it. And so they took it out. So I don't see the adoption of Bitcoin as being that high in the sense that matters, which is as money, not just as this like sort of speculative asset.
Right. And we could get into the, you know, the whole evolution of money, store of value versus medium exchange, all of that. But I do want to talk with you about some other things.
Okay, sure.
It's super interesting to hear your perspective on all of this. One of those things, you know, early on, I read you had a focus on, and you mentioned earlier, you had a focus on like drones, supersonic flight, even flying cars. You know, not often I've been able to speak with someone who has a perspective on all of these things, where we are today, where we're going. Obviously, you spent some time at Boom, which recently announced, I think it was called the XB-1, the supersonic aircraft. So would love to hear, you know, your thoughts on where we are both there with supersonic flight, you know, flying from New York to London in a few hours, as well as on drones. And then lastly, if you have any thoughts on like flying cars, whatever research you did into that and how that might compare with like Elon Musk's vision with the Boring Company of bringing stuff underground.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I still love supersonics and I'm, you know, continue to watch and cheer on my former colleagues at Boom, and they have an actual supersonic airplane built now. So I think the first supersonic airplane that wasn't built by a government in history. There wasn't, you know, developed and built by a government. So you know, that is a subscale demonstrator that will fly hopefully next year. But at the same time, there's a bunch of other new supersonic companies that are sort of joining the fray, which is really exciting. So you know, sort of along with Boom and that sort of like first wave, there was a company called Aireon that's working on a Mach 1.4 business jet, and I think they're at a point where, you know, basically they need to raise money to like build the factory, and they're ready to go. So they're actually maybe a little ahead of Boom in that way. And then you've seen, you know, Virgin Galactic is now talking about getting into supersonics. There's a company called Hermias in Atlanta that is working on a Mach 5 airplane, which is amazing. Even, you know, by far would be the fastest passenger plane. There's a company called Exosonic out of some Stanford aero grads.
Just to butt in, what's the difference between Mach 5, supersonic, what we have today for people like myself who are pretty unfamiliar?
Sure. So today, your sort of like airliners, Boeing and Airbus airliners, they cruise at about Mach 0.85. So less than Mach 1, and anything above Mach 1 is considered supersonic. Concorde, which, you know, was developed in the 1960s and 70s, flew at Mach 2. Boom is designing at Mach 2.2. Aireon's designing at Mach 1.4. I don't think Virgin has said yet, but I think they're talking about Mach 3-ish. Hermias is doing Mach 5. And then there's a company called Exosonic that's doing a low boom design, so low sonic boom, but they're designing at Mach 1.8. So there's pretty big diversity in all these approaches, but I think it's really interesting and healthy that people are looking at these different design points and figuring out what's going to work, and then sort of like in the sort of like more fanciful future, there's this idea that SpaceX has of like using, you know, rockets to do point-to-point travel across the Earth, and that would be like, you know, Mach 20 or something like that, super fast. So Mach 1 is around in the atmosphere. Mach 1 is about once you get above, you know, really close to the ground, Mach 1 is about 660 miles per hour. So just, you know, Mach 5 is five times that. So it's pretty fast.
Got it. So yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt on that.
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's really great. The U.S. is a leader in this. The sort of the policy environment has been now it's pretty welcoming. initially when I started, it you know, there was some pushback, but I think we've got that nipped at least domestically. You do see a lot of pushback still in Europe, where sort of the European governments, like they just want to protect like Airbus and Dassault, the European airframers, and those companies don't have supersonic projects yet. And so Europe's sort of pushing back on supersonics and trying to slow down the whole process. But I think it's moving forward. And, you know, I think it's pretty plausible that by around 2030-ish, you know, we will see entry into service of a supersonic or hypersonic airliner, right? So something that you could actually, you know, take your crypto earnings and buy a ticket and, you know, go across the Atlantic or the Pacific, you know, at two or five times faster than you're able to go today.
That would tie all these technologies together pretty nicely.
Yeah, and I think it's a huge deal because, you know, speed, the time that you spend, and you know, on a plane is a cost, right? And so, what the way that sort of like the spatial, the distance works in trade and in economic activity is it follows kind of a gravity law. So you think about like two cities like New York and London. they trade with each other kind of in a way that is modeled on like sort of like Newtonian gravity, right? So you have the mass of New York, right? Its economic size, and you have the mass of London, its economic size, and they trade with each other proportionally to like the economic distance between them, like the cost of getting around like between them, and including both money and time. And by reducing the time between to get between any two places, you're sort of reducing the economic distance, which should increase economic activity that happens, you know, across that space. So I think about this sort of like speed increases as about radically accelerating the sort of economic activity that happens between two faraway places. So I think it's potentially a big game changer. You know, the sort of the past eras of speed changes, like when we went from steamships to from sail ships to steamships, that had a huge impact on global trade, on globalization, on the amount of economic activity, and on growth. So to me, like, faster travel is a big deal.
Right. Yeah, that all makes good sense. On the latter portion of the couple of things that I mentioned, any thoughts on drones and where we're at there?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that the interesting stuff is more on the cargo side, right? Moving stuff around, as opposed to like just drones in the air sensing stuff. You know, cameras pointed at the ground or something like that. So I really think that the cargo stuff could be very interesting, but what's going to have to happen to make that work is for FAA and other regulators to start allowing some degree of autonomy. So allowing, you know, right now, you know, basically you can get a waiver from the FAA to do some kind of drone operation as long as you have like one remote pilot per drone, you know, sort of like, so you have that remote pilot who has to have a pilot's license, at least a Part 107 license. And that person has to be like sitting in an operation center somewhere and like controlling the drone on sort of like a one-to-one basis, you know, allowing autonomy and getting to the point where, you know, you have an operator who's operating 20 drones at a time or 50 drones at a time, or just there in case something goes wrong. I think that's what's going to have to happen to let that kind of activity scale. And so far, you know, regulators have been reluctant to allow that. And then when you get into urban air mobility, you know, what people call flying cars, I think it's the same thing. There are people working on these sort of vertical takeoffs and landing electric vehicles. But right now, FAA is still contemplating those having pilots. And there's not a clear path on how you would do that with remote piloting and, you know, especially the sort of like one-to-many relationship between them. So that's like it's technical work, but it's also regulatory work that's going to need to happen to enable that. And, you know, I think it's super exciting when we get there. I mean, think about, you know, with this pandemic, in terms of cargo deliveries, how useful it would be to just be able to, you know, get your groceries, you know, delivered more quickly or, you know, really anything, delivered to your house or your apartment, you know, within, you know, 10 minutes of you ordering it, via drone. I think it's super exciting. And it's really that one, I think, big hurdle still from a regulatory perspective it will happen, but they've got to figure out how they're going to do it. So I think that's the biggest obstacle right now to making that really a big part of a lot of people's lives.
Right. So we keep butting up kind of on policy and regulation, and you know, you mentioned how there's, you know, there's technical work, but then there's also regulation type work. You obviously operate kind of at the nexus between technology and policy, and You know, I've heard you talk a little bit on another great podcast. I think it was called The Great Antidote. You went really deep on this topic, and so I wanted to cover something a little bit different today. But can you talk a little bit about how regulation and innovation are related? And, you know, especially today, you talk about like, or you know, your mentor and advisor, Tyler, wrote the book on the great stagnation. And, you know, Paul Tudor Jones earlier this year, I don't know you read, but writes about like the great monetary inflation. So you kind of have inflation and stagnation seemingly creating the perfect storm. How do you think about all of this in terms of what we need to do with regulation, whether it's feasible, and how innovation can kind of be let loose a little bit?
Yeah, so we need to just be a lot less complacent about the need to actually try to stimulate growth and like real growth in the economy, not nominal growth, had nothing to do with like the inflation stuff. Just thinking about just the real portion of the economy, like real resources, turning it into real output as efficiently as possible, right? And so the metric for that is called total factor productivity. It's, you know, how, if you take a basket of representative resources, how much output can you create with that in terms of value? And, you know, from the end of World War II to about 1973, we had about 2% per year TFP growth. And then very suddenly in the early 1970s, it fell to below 1% per year. And in the last 15 years, I just looked this up and it's 0.26%. So it's really, I think it's about an eighth of where it was in the sort of pre-1973 economy. And yeah, I think a lot of it is tied to regulation. One of the things that I've looked at pretty deeply is just the effect of permitting requirements. So in the US, there's a law called NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, basically says, you know, if you need a permit and you need to go to a federal agency, anytime that a federal agency takes a major action, they have to study what the environmental impacts are of that action. Whether there is an impact or not, right, they have to study it one way or the other. And that can take years. So, and it's hundreds of pages. And so if you look at a lot of the things that we need to do to make the future, you know, happen, it's being held up by this sort of paperwork requirement. So one example I like to think about is the Boring Company, which you mentioned earlier, which I also, you know, I also think we need that, not just urban air mobility, but also tunnels. Let's do everything. So the Boring Company right now is actually planning to build a tunnel between DC and Baltimore. And to do this, they need a federal permit because they're doing it under some federal land under the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. And right now they're just sort of sitting, waiting for that permit to be approved. They've done the paperwork and it's taking years. And, you know, so the Boring Company, you know, it's financed by Elon Musk, who's one of the richest people in the world. And maybe he doesn't care so much about what the rate of return is on that investment, but the sort of like 4 or 5 years, a lot of times you have to sit around waiting for the paperwork to be done. That wreaks havoc with investors' rate of return, right? So you could take a rate of return that would be pretty good without that delay. And if you add in that delay where you have to have, you know, sort of the capital all ready to go, and then you're not allowed to like put a shovel in the ground for 5 years, that rate of return is going to be much lower. And so the investors are going to pass on that. They're going to say, no, we don't want to do that. And so to a considerable extent, I think that the future isn't being invested in enough. And I think it's largely for these regulatory reasons, or yes, in this case, it's a legislative reason that the agency has to comply with the law that Congress has passed. And so it is, you know, it's to me, it's something that's worth making progress on, because, you know, economic growth is something that improves all of our lives. And you know, sort of, I think when the economy is growing fast, you also get much better, much healthier society. You get a, you know, sort of less populism, less distrust, and more just everyone's happy because their personal situation is improving, and so they kind of want to keep it going. So so I think it is, you know, something, it is my sort of like my main research focus now is like how to get the economy moving a whole lot faster, and you know, I think it's super important.
Right. So, you know, you spoke about how regulation in certain industries, like with, you know, the Boring Company trying to get the permits to go underground, and MEPA on some of the environmental stuff. You've also got like the FDA, where a drug approval from, you know, inception to going to market can take like a decade. We're seeing certain efforts to accelerate that process now with COVID. But even still, you could argue that it's not enough. And I've heard you talk about how, like, you think we should decrease our, I guess, increase our risk tolerance and our threshold to accept things that may not be perfect and try them earlier. And I think it's interesting, you know, across all of these categories, you talk about like self-driving cars as well, where, it doesn't seem to me, I'm no expert, but it doesn't seem to me that regulation is really doing any favors. There's no tremendous effort by government to support Tesla or Google, for example, in their efforts to bring this technology more quickly in terms of advancing it and then bringing it to market. And you know, a ton of people, you know, automobile accidents from a young age to, I think, 30s are the leading cause of death in the United States. And it's just like something that we've kind of accepted as like a cost of doing what we do. But in reality, you know, regulation could play a large part in helping bring us towards these better futures that I think you're hinting at, where, you know, we can bring drugs to market quicker. We can help people, you know, not die from car accidents quite as much, and help people travel quicker and cargo move quicker, and just make the world grow more quickly, you know, as measured by the statistic that you brought up earlier, the total factor productivity. And I think it's important, like with the whole narrative that, you know, the media and everything takes on today, it's very risk averse. I actually just heard like a quote from Balaji, which was basically saying that Balaji Srinivasan that said, I think excessive risk aversion is the greatest risk of all, something like that. And
sure, yeah.
And it's interesting to me, like you talked about how the statistic, you know, objectively has dropped from like 2 to 0.2 in the last 40 or 50 years, whatever it was. And to me, I can kind of see how that relates, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like that would relate to society just taking less risk, and risk is always, you know, you look at stocks or anything, risk is always related with reward, and the more risk you take, the more you tend to get rewarded. So is that something that you feel that we need to start, like, how do you actually see, you know, it's one thing to say regulations are slowing things down, but is there actually a path that you see to start improving in some of these ways, taking more risks, convincing government to change a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, so the car point that you brought up is great. You know, we have 40,000 people in the US that die every year from cars, and we just sort of accept it. And if you had, you know, if cars had never been invented, and we, you know, I came today and said, okay, I have a car, you know, 40,000 people a year are going to die from this. There's no way that that would be allowed to be introduced on the market today. So, so that's, I mean, that's spot on. You know, the way I look at sort of how to get meaningful economic growth is to focus on specific areas where I think we've had stagnating productivity. So, So the stagnation in productivity hasn't been even. There's been some areas where productivity has been amazing, and some areas where it's been terrible, right? And so an example of an area where it's been amazing is TVs. So if you think about how much TVs you know, cost 10 years ago, if, you know, if you wanted to buy a, you know, 65 inch TV 10 years ago, you know, you're talking, you know, $10,000 or something like that, right? And now you can get one pretty cheap, you know, maybe a tenth of that or less. And, you know, so what has happened as a result of that is that, like, TVs have become a less important part of our economy. Like, the amount of that consumers are spending on TVs as a percentage of GDP has gone down. And then the converse is true in a few other areas where productivity has slowed. And productivity is growing more slowly, then the price doesn't come down. It actually maybe goes up in real terms. And as a result, these areas tend to balloon as a function of, as a proportion of GDP. And those, you know, sort of the two biggest areas are health and housing. So health is now 18% of GDP and housing is 16% of GDP. So, you know, just between the two of those, that's 34% of GDP on these two stagnating sectors. And if you can sort of figure out sort of regulatory levers to drive technology development and adoption in those two areas, and maybe institutional improvements as well, not just pure technology, but institutional improvements also, you could, you know, massively increase human welfare by just focusing on those two areas. And then I think, you know, a couple other areas that are really important, they're not final components of GDP, so they don't tally in the same way that health and housing do, but energy and transportation are basically inputs to a lot of things. And, you know, sort of the promise, if you think about, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, was we're going to eventually have clean energy that's too cheap to meter, right? We were going to have fusion energy or, you know, other kinds of nuclear energy. And it was going to be so cheap that we wouldn't even have, you know, an electricity meter on our house. You know, to me, like, we obviously have this climate problem we have to address, but, like, to me, the goal needs to be this sort of, like, really abundant, amazing energy supply that is, you know, zero carbon, but also, like, super, super cheap. And, you know, we want to have a future where we use more energy, not less. And then in transportation, you know, sort of the same thing. We've had this huge disappointment relative to where we thought we would be. You know, as I mentioned, we had supersonic passenger airliners operating with people buying tickets on them in the 1970s. And now we don't, right? It's gone away. Like, we've lost a capability. So bringing transportation up to date with, you know, a new generation of supersonics, with urban air mobility, with drones for cargo, with autonomous cars, you know, with amazing tunnels that shoot us from place to place really fast. All of that is super important. And if we, I think very highly levered in terms of, if we did that, you'd get a lot of bang for your buck in terms of, you know, ultimately what we care about, which is economic growth.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great perspective. And I think it's super helpful to think of it broken down, for me at least, like, into housing and health as the two kind of big ones, adding up to, I think, 30%+ of GDP, said, and then beyond that, transportation and energy as well, just falling far short of what one would have expected we might have by this point, you know, 50 years ago. I know we're coming up on time, so I want to wrap up with a last question. I want to talk about the tracker that you made for the recent election. It was super cool. I found it. I think Naval retweeted it. And, you know, I checked it the night of the election as they were still counting the votes and everything, which obviously went on for a few days. But at a certain point, it was suggesting that Trump was going to win. And obviously this isn't like your website being wrong or anything. It was all based on data from the betting markets. And then mm-hmm. I woke up in the morning and it was tilted heavily towards Biden. And that's obviously the way it seems to have gone. Would love to hear the story if you can, on like how that came to be. And fast forwarding to now, I just checked it before the call, and like, there's still this 7% chance that Trump wins. And that's not, again, your website. That's the betting markets all have that. And so some people are saying like it's free money to bet against Trump at this point because he obviously hasn't won. But what do you think's going on there, if you have any thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. So I mean, I made this site because I've always, for 20 years now, I've been pretty interested in betting markets as a way of sort of doing forecasting, doing predictions, right? A lot of times, the other ways we have of doing this sort of kind of forecasting is we just ask experts who are just, pundits who basically have no skin in the game and just make a prediction and are sort of like famous for their predictions. And then, if they predict wrong, like nothing happens to them. Like other ways of doing it are polling, right? We have polls in the elections and they didn't turn out so well. We have, sort of other ways, sort of like the hybrid model where you have somebody like Nate Silver who's taking the polls and then doing some mathematical magic to them to try to like make them better. That didn't perform well this time around. Betting markets have always just interested me. So I've sort of have run sites and little trackers for elections for the last, 5 years at least, or 5 or 6 years. So I've been following stuff with the betting markets for a while since like the 2015 primaries. I just think it's super interesting. So basically this site has sort of just accreted features over time. And so it used to be just a little table that tracked the odds and then sort of added the Monte Carlo model and added the map and added Senate races and added, a bunch of different things. And ultimately it was like sort of like a one page full featured page that that had all the information you really needed to follow the election, and it was dynamic, unlike sort of like a poll based forecast. Like there's no new polls that happen as the sort of returns start coming in. And I think on election night, the networks kind of did a bad job of kind of explaining to people like where we were, especially when sort of the returns in Florida started coming in. And that was a state that the polls all had going to Biden, but the betting markets all had going to Trump. And there wasn't really a good explanation of like, okay, what does this mean? And sort of like using the betting markets as an aggregator, I think, makes a lot of sense. And in terms of the sort of like the remaining sort of 7% chance that Trump could win, I think that is, I think that's probably too high, that estimate. I think it's a very, vanishingly small chance that Trump would be able to do it. So I don't think that betting markets are perfect. They're not perfectly efficient yet. But I think that that's actually, something we could work towards. Part of the reason that they're not efficient is that they not everybody can participate in them. So like the Betfair markets that I use are the most liquid ones in the world. But US residents are not able to like open up accounts and bet on there because for regulatory reasons. So one of the things that I'm really interested in actually is blockchain-based betting markets that, decentralized, unowned blockchain-based betting markets. So I'm hoping that by the 2024 election, if you look at sites like Omen and Augur, they're hurting right now because of the high Ethereum fees, and they're not as liquid as they could be. But maybe by 2024, Ethereum will have scaled a bit, and we'll be able to base an election tracker on sort of hopefully much more open and heavily used blockchain-based betting markets. I should add one other thought is that, I think that I would like to see many more people consulting betting markets just for summary of like what's going to happen. So like, in terms of like coronavirus, what are the number of cases going to be? And, you could even have conditional markets. Like what are the cases going to be if we lock down? What are the cases going to be if we don't? And then use that to like sort of inform your opinion about whether whether we should lock down, right? You could actually have like a data-driven consensus on what reality looks like. Right now, nobody trusts the other side to, in terms of the narrative. But if you had sort of like a core consensus based on betting markets that we all agreed on, then we could have, real discussions about values and when it's worth doing this and when it's not worth doing this. But we would have this sort of like shared consensus that we all agree on of like what the facts are. And I think that that is, something to aspire to. And it would be, really great if we could all consult, the markets more often and use them as sort of a trusted data point about what the world is actually like.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I mean, obviously people are doing their best by whatever means they can to predict the future, but to have this somewhat new tool that could be enabled by crypto combined with the prediction markets to, not necessarily that they're going to be right, but they might be more accurate, it sounds like, than, for the election, for example, something like polling. And more importantly, maybe they're also adapting in real time, where polling and alternative measures of kind of predicting or modeling the future don't have that feature, and have their biases of whatever side they might take of the narrative or of the argument. But yeah, I mean, I was, watching on TV a little bit, like you mentioned, they weren't doing necessarily the best job. And then I kept coming back to like Twitter, and then ultimately it was just like following your website to inform my view of how things were going to turn out. So really cool talking with you today. And I want to give you the last word to tell people where they can go find your website and follow you on Twitter and anything else we may not have had the chance to discuss. But I know your overarching goal is to have GDP per capita reach, I think it was $200,000 by 2050. Is that right? And I hope that,
that's right. Yeah.
I hope that that comes to fruition.
Yeah, sure. So everybody has political slogans and, sort of the progress movement didn't have one. So I thought I would try to make one. So 200K by 2050. So thanks so much for having me on. People can find me on Twitter. My handle is Eli Dorado, and also on the web at elidorado.com.